Celebration of the 50th anniversary of the invention of the laser. We're very fortunate to have three laser pioneers who can tell us firsthand about the major developments in the laser. Yeah. I do want to emphasize what's up on the board, that this is sponsored by the Forum on the History of Physics and the Topical Group on Precision Measurements and Fundamental Constants, and like to take the opportunity to join the Forum on the History of Physics if you are not already a member. The reasons are listed up there. It's helpful to us in bringing these sessions forward, and it should be interesting for you, and it's free. So our first speaker is Joe Jordan-May. I should mention that this session is being recorded, so it will be posted on the web by the Forum on the History of Physics, the visual presentations, and the audio record.
Good morning. On May 16th of 1960, laser light was generated in the lab for the first time. Ted Maiman at Hughes Research Lab in California positioned a ruby crystal with parallel silvered faces inside a xenon flash lamp. At a certain flash intensity, the red fluorescence of the ruby suddenly changed, peaking at 694 nanometers, narrowing in line width, decreasing in lifetime, clear evidence of regenerative amplification by stimulated emission. Today, 50 years later, the laser ranks as one of the most important inventions of the 20th century. It's hard to find a corner of technology or science that hasn't been benefited by it in some way or even transformed, as we heard last night at the public lecture in many ways. Broadband communications, navigation, eye surgery, precision measurements, CD players, barcode scanners, even tests of the stability of the fundamental constants. In this talk, hopefully in the spirit of LaserFest, I'd like to first summarize the background that led to this development. I'll then recall some of what happened afterwards. And to make the account manageable, I'm going to limit the story today to the earliest and perhaps the least familiar years, 1960 to 1962, so that most of what we heard last night at the public lecture hasn't even been thought about yet. My own involvement with this field began about 4 years earlier, in 1956 at Columbia as a graduate student of Charles Townes, with the thesis project of building a low-noise Maser amplifier for radio astronomy. And after 61, I continued at Bell Labs doing research in nonlinear optics and other laser physics. First, the background. Stimulated emission was known to physics at least since 1916, when Einstein published his famous derivation of the Planck law of radiation, which is in all the textbooks. From that derivation, you see that to explain the Planck law of radiation, you've got to invoke stimulated emission as well as induced emission and spontaneous emission. By the middle of the 1920s, media under non-equilibrium conditions, and also with even inverted populations, higher population greater than a lower population, were being considered actively as part of theories of radiation and interaction with matter. Crummers, Van Vleck, Tolman all talked about induced emission and negative absorption, increasing the intensity of light waves, such as in media having an inversion. Ladenburg and Kopferman, in experiments of high discharge currents in gases in 1928, were able to populate excited states sufficiently to reduce dispersion and to approach actually negative absorption. They didn't follow up, but they were close. Fabricant in 1939 actually looked for negative absorption. Lamb and Rutherford in 47 recognized the possibility of population inversion in the states they were looking at for the Lamb shift. And in 51, Purcell and Pound discussed inverted populations of nuclear spins in terms of negative temperatures. In 52, Joe Weber published a paper in an IRE journal with some theoretical ideas and specific suggestions for a molecular amplifier. For the 35 years that followed Einstein's paper on stimulated emission, no effort was ever pursued very far. In some cases, this was because the potential for new physics wasn't obvious. In other cases, because there were no clear short or long-term useful applications for negative absorption. It was a kind of curiosity. But particularly because no one made the connection between stimulated emission and resonant cavities. The difficulty of the next step was later stated very aptly by Willis Lamb, and I quote, "The concept of negative absorption was new to us at the time. I think that we understood that the radiation would be coherent, as was the input signal. However, we did not associate negative absorption with self-sustained oscillation. Even if we had done so, at least three factors would have prevented us from inventing the laser, the maser. Our interest was centered on hydrogen fine structure, the smallness of the gain or loss, and doubt about its sign, and the ready availability of oscillators at the frequency used." In other words, no real reason to get interested in this. The breakthrough idea that opened a path to the maser, and ultimately the laser, came to Charles Townes in Franklin Park, just a short distance from this hotel, as a matter of fact, and just at the time of this April meeting, although in those simpler times, the April meeting was held in April. Townes was a microwave spectroscopist with a lot of microwave radar experience. He was in Washington to chair a meeting of a committee that had been set up to explore new approaches to generating shorter wavelengths, namely infrared, near millimeter wave infrared and so on. He was frustrated at the committee's lack of progress, short list of new ideas and recommendations. He got out early one morning, as you probably know the story, sat on a bench among the azaleas and asked himself why there was nothing getting done. The result was the idea of a molecular oscillator consisting of nothing more than a beam of excited atoms passing into an empty resonator and coherent light, coherent microwaves coming out. The beam would be formed by passing ordinary ammonia gas through an electrostatic focuser, selectively directing molecules into the focuser, into the resonator, and then getting amplification. He realized that the amplification, he calculated, would be large enough to offset losses due to absorption and the output coupling of the resonator, and that self-sustained oscillations could occur. And that was the that was the breakthrough moment. In 1954, a maser oscillated and was constructed by Jim Gordon, Townes' graduate student, postdoc Herb Zeiger, and generated extremely monochromatic microwaves at 24 gigahertz. Very soon afterwards, a similar ammonia beam maser was demonstrated by Prokhorov and Basov at the Lebedev Institute. They had, in fact, already published a theoretical paper on molecular oscillators. One they picked at that time was cesium fluoride, which would have required much higher cavity Qs than did ammonia. A further idea that was essential both for further progress on masers and for the laser was the idea of three-level pumping by Bloembergen. That was in the summer of 1956. In the two-level maser, such as ammonia, the resonator has to be continuously replenished by putting in fresh inverted material. In the three-level solid-state maser, based on energy level, say, 1, 2, and 3, in that order, level 1 to level 3 transition, creating a population inversion between levels 2 and 3, making possible a continuously operating amplifier. Three-level maser projects were clearly recognized right away as opening the way to real solid-state masers. And projects immediately sprung up in a lot of laboratories, and the scheme was first demonstrated in a solid-state maser by Scoville, Fair, and Seidel at Bell Labs, December 56. In December 57, Ruby, which is outstanding maser material, had been introduced by the University of Michigan group, and this opened the way, actually, for us at Columbia to get our thesis done on that microwave amplifier to our great relief, and that was done by 1960. And it was with a Ruby maser amplifier several years later that Penzias and Wilson at Bell Labs discovered the cosmic background radiation of the Big Bang. In the summer of 57, Townes began to work in earnest on optical masers. In September 57, he made a notebook entry proposing an optically pumped metal vapor maser at optical frequencies and calculating the oscillation threshold condition. He had me witness the notebook entry. By the late fall, Townes, who was then a Bell Labs consultant, started working with Art Schallow and began a collaboration on the theory and specific details of an optical maser. They filed a Bell Labs patent application shortly after and submitted a paper to Physical Review. The final proposal, which is based on potassium vapor, included the key idea, a really central idea suggested by Art Schawlow, in fact, of directional mode selection using a resonator formed by small, widely spaced plane mirrors, or transparent reflectors, and non-existent or lossy sidewalls. Those were the keys. Gordon Gould, a graduate student of Polycarp Cush at Columbia, comes into the picture at this point, shortly after Towns' initial notebook entry. Towns talked to Gould about Towns' Maser ideas, and asked him for intensity data on metal vapor lamps for the Towns experiment. And then in November, Gould had his own notebook pages notarized, outlining the feasibility of an optical amplifier, including an elongated cavity with parallel end faces. Gould named this device a laser. These and later notebook entries became the basis of a prolonged court battle over patent rights to the laser. In the end, the courts awarded the laser claim to Schawlow and Towns. After many setbacks, however, Gould secured lucrative patents in 1977 on areas related to optically pumped laser amplification on an amplifier, which was great because every laser has to have an amplifier. Until late in 58, there was little other research activity on lasers. After the Schawlow-Towns paper became available in August of that year, the idea that a laser could be built became widely accepted, and research got underway or was expanded in a number of labs, IBM, Bell Labs, TRG, Hughes, American Optical, as well as at Columbia. A conference chaired by Towns was held at Shawanga Lodge in September of 1959. And it focused on microwave physics and engineering, but it was really the scene for a lot of discussions about possibilities for lasers. The conference became the occasion for a lot of discussions. Just quote one, in his talk at Shawanga, Schawlow said, quote, "The structure of a solid-state maser could be extremely simple. In essence, it would be just a rod with one end totally reflecting and the other nearly so. The sides would be left clear to admit pumping radiation." During subsequent months, laser action was pursued from several different directions. Towns and Oliver Heavens, Cummins and Abella, graduate students worked on optically pumped alkali metal vapors. But they turned out to be terribly difficult to work with. At Bell Labs, Ali Javon, joined by Bennett and Harriet, worked with helium neon gas discharges. At IBM, Sorokin Stevenson chose four-level uranium, samarium impurities, and calcium fluoride, where lower states were available with negligible population. Maiman at Hughes, I keep trying to turn on someone else's computer here. Maiman at Hughes chose ruby, an unlikely source, since the lower state for the three-level transition, the R1 transition, the lower state has to be at least 50% depopulated in order to pump through these pumping bands down to the excited state for the laser transition, which doesn't seem like a very palatable way of doing things. However, Maiman did careful calculations, and he had to face another question. The work of others had suggested that the quantum efficiency, the fraction of quanta that you get in this state from, say, 100 quanta going up here, was something like 1. It was something the order of 1%, according to available data. Maiman didn't believe it. He insisted on doing his own calculations and found that it was closer to 100%. He did tests on it, starting to empty the lower state using small light sources, and calculated that with really powerful pulsed pumps that this would work. And he really worked in the face of skepticism from everybody. Maiman mounted an available, what he called, ruby crystal of 1 centimeter dimensions, coated on 2 parallel faces of silver in a commercial xenon photographic flash lamp. Spectrum of the flash lamp was well matched to the broadband pumping bands of ruby and provided pulsed light power. at tens of kilowatts, mindful of the fact that other people in the field were working with milliwatts of pump power from spectral lamps. At high flash energy, Maiman observed lasing at 0.69 microns, as evidenced by the R1 line sharpening, the very sudden change in the ratio of fluorescence from the R1 and R2 lines, and the drop in the R1 line lifetime. This was clearly stimulated emission and lasing. For whatever reason, no one really seemed to have considered doing pumping of these systems with flash lamps. There are a lot of reasons. It's a long story why not, but that's a very interesting situation. His elegant and deceptively simple achievement of the first laser was an unexpected breakthrough, a complete surprise for everybody. Ironically, his paper, which was titled Optical Maser Action, referees, was rejected by Physical Review Letters because Maser physics was considered sufficiently mature that further advances did not merit rapid publication. It was finally published in Nature in August. The first published account of a narrow, spatially coherent ruby laser beam was in fact submitted by another group that reproduced his experiments, Collins, Kaiser, Schallow, and others at Bell Labs a few weeks later. They used a higher quality ruby crystal, which Maiman did around the same time. They gave a public demonstration of the ruby laser in October, and they reported on the intense relaxation oscillation spikes and other features, the narrow spectral width reduced from to about 0.2 wave numbers. You can compare that with what we heard about last evening, from the fluorescence line width of 6 wave numbers. And emission at the end reflectors was spatially coherent over about 100 wavelengths. Now this year we also celebrate the 50th anniversary of the helium neon laser, which was the first laser to operate continuously, as well as 3 new solid state lasers, all reported 1 month, December 1960. Here they are in chronological order. The first was by Peter Sorokin, Murek Stevenson, IBM Labs, and operated at 2.5 microns. It used uranium plus 3 impurities and calcium fluoride, and differed from ruby in that in the energy levels of calcium uranium 3 plus, the ground state for the transition is not the actual ground state in the crystal, so that the population of the ground state, the lower state for the laser transition, is pretty close to empty. This means that the pumping power that they needed was about 500 times less than ruby required. So this was an enormous step forward. Second new solid-state laser was also by Sorokin and Stevenson. It ran at 0.71 microns. In this case, they had a smaller bottleneck in the pumping process, and which allowed it to work without the spikes that are characteristic of a lot of the Maser oscillation. And then similar results on that material came from Kaiser, Garrett, and Wood as well. Two groups then reported the same month a different type of ruby maser based on operating at a higher chromium concentration than the usual pink ruby. And these satellite lines again gave a 4-level situation in which the lower state for the laser transition was enough above the ground state that it was unpopulated and the pumping power was much less than ordinary ruby. The first continuously operating ruby laser which it was in helium neon gas was reported on December 30, 1960 by Javon, Bennett, and Harriet, Bell Labs. They demonstrated in public on January 31st. It had a new pumping method. Population inversions were obtained between pairs of neon levels. Populations were obtained between pairs of levels in this group, triplet S, these are the neon levels, these are the helium levels, between 3S levels and these 2P levels. And the one that works the best and strongest is 1.15 microns. Now this 2S level is populated by, in a discharge, by having a large concentration of helium helium atoms, which are excited by electron collisions to this excited triplet S state, which by collisions exchanges energy with this and leaves you with an inversion between this level and this level. And this was the result, this laser working was the result of about 2.5 year spectroscopic study of this whole system, which became very well understood. That kind of spectroscopic study soon stopped when later on people looking for new lines simply used a laser as a, you used a tube with a gas with two mirrors at the end as a kind of analog computer to decide whether the laser action was possible. Later in that year, well, the result was a beam of spread less than 1 minute of arc, and later they mixed the output of this ruby and the second of this laser and the second helium neon laser that they built, each running in a free running but in a single mode, and demonstrated that the stability was about one megahertz over 100 seconds. But if you look at the real monochromaticity of the light over a few seconds, you know, isolated from all the microphonics and other things going on, the beats, it's an audio beat, which you could hear, which is an amazing thing to listen to. And over a period of a few cycles, you could see that the monochromaticity was a part in 10 to the 14th, or namely, a few cycles. During the next 2 years, work on lasers and quantum electronics grew exponentially. The number of active groups in the United States and Europe increased from 50 in 1960 to, one estimate was more than 500 in the U.S. alone in less than 2 years. Most of the publications came from industrial labs, and optics made more ground in university EE departments than it did in physics departments. Commercial lasers became available. New journals started. Sputnik encouraged strong military support of the area. DoD support of laser research grew about a factor of 8 between 1960 and 1962. For the research physicist, it was an exuberant and fast-moving field. New lines were turning up. Simpler experiments could be set up in a few days, in some cases, and it was possible to test speculative ideas without risking too much time. But there were a lot of basic questions that had to be answered, some of them very practical, some of them quite very fundamental. One question that always bothered me as a graduate student and later was, what is the meaning of an open resonator? What do you mean by having two little reflectors like this separated by so long? That isn't what we study in the physics books at that time about what a resonator is. And that question got answered. Gardner Fox and others started did a calculation, numerical calculation, starting with an arbitrary field distribution at one resonator, followed it to the other resonator, and just followed this with a very large number of reflections until a steady state was achieved. And in fact, in the steady state, they did find a self-reproducing distribution of amplitude and phase over the mirrors. Subsequent work was done with spherical mirrors and showed the great advantages of confocal resonators, spherical resonators generally. And Boyd and Kogelnik introduced the idea of stable and unstable resonators. And we became familiar with laser mode patterns. And new types of resonator came. Garrett and Kaiser, for example, talked about or showed resonator action in spheres, in the whispering modes of spheres. On the fundamental side, would semi-classical theory, now with the lasers here, would semi-classical theory of light be adequate to describe the intensity correlations and the other statistical properties of laser light? Could lasers provide direct evidence of the photon nature of light, which you could get along without to a very high degree of accuracy? These questions would only begin to be answered during 60 to 62. Roy Glauber's paper on photon correlations at the end of 62 gave general expressions for states of light that did have statistical properties different from classical light and provided clues, at least, of where to look for purely quantum effects. The interaction of light in a resonant cavity. That was studied in detail by Jaynes and Cummings. That's a long story. That paper had a lot of influence. But the field had to wait 15 years for an unambiguous experimental evidence of the photon nature of light before things like squeeze states started to be seen. Ruby laser prompted intensive search for other new solid-state maser materials. Time doesn't permit going into any detail here. And a big step forward was seeing laser action in glass because of the possibility of high power and energy that it offered. In the area of gas lasers, an alkali metal vapor finally lased. And that was done by a TRG by Rabinowitz, Steve Jacobs, and Gould, and was a three-level pumped scheme. And at Bell Labs, a similar scheme, which there isn't time to discuss here, namely dissociative excitation transfer, where a state of a molecule is excited in a dissociative state and can give its energy to the atoms resulting from the dissociation. A big step was the in 1962 when White and Rigdon took a helium neon system and put mirrors on it that resonated at this red wavelength, 6328, which is pumped by the population excited into this singlet S level rather than the triplet S level of helium, which does the pumping through collisions. And in fact, that worked. And indeed, the 6328 laser was the laser for very many, many years until semiconductor lasers came around. That was the first laser that was mass-produced for use at supermarket checkout counters. And the amazing thing about the 6328 laser is that the first time you see it and light things up with it, you see speckle, which is an amazing, amazing phenomenon when you first see it. And these speckle patterns, each spot is the order of the airy disk diameter for the optics involved. There was an important advance in gas laser physics at this point by Bennett at Bell Labs. He studied saturation in the gas laser system and showed and observed that with a three-mode system, that saturation, if you have light off the line center, it's really talking to molecules symmetrically distributed on both sides of the line center. When the system is tuned to the center of the line, that isn't the case anymore, which means that if you saturate the line and pass over it, the feature that you see at the line center is a lot narrower than the spectral width of the line itself. They followed that up, and the effect was later developed in detail by Willis Lamb in his theory of the laser, and it's now known as the Lamb dip. The Lamb dip is much narrower than the Doppler line, but maybe a order of magnitude at the most. And later refinements, for example, by John Hall and Dick Brewer, achieved line widths within an order of magnitude of the natural line widths of a few hertz. Period 61 to 62 was the opening of a new field, nonlinear optics, by Peter Franken and his group at University of Michigan. And in March of 61, he got the idea that in a laser beam, focused laser beam, the fields are as large as 10 to the 5th volts per centimeter. That's within about a factor of 10,000 or so of an atomic electric field. And just pushed by that idea, he estimated that a laser beam, the second harmonic component of optical polarization in a solid, would radiate enough power at twice the frequency to be detectable. So he quickly organized a small group, including Gabriel Reinreich, rented a ruby laser head from a newly formed laser company, and quickly began experiments. At this point, Weinrich, who's a solid-state theorist, came up with a crucial observation, and that is that without this, the experiment wouldn't have succeeded. He informed everyone in the group that a polarization vector representing the polarization proportional to the square of a vector electric field can only occur in a crystal without a center of symmetry. That's obvious after you think about it for a little bit, but you have to be in a position to think about it for a little bit. Now, this meant that things would only work with a piezoelectric crystal. In their experiments, ruby pulse of about 10 to the 19 photons generated about 10 to the 11 UV photons, and it was reported in a famous physical review letter submitted in July 61, which included their first spectrogram of the focused spot of a second harmonic light, of the second harmonic light, and it was blank. The historic UV spot was assumed by the printers to be a dust particle and was airbrushed out. Almost simultaneously with the Franken paper, Kaiser and Garrett demonstrated quite another nonlinear optical process, quite different from that coherent process. This is work done by Kaiser and Garrett at Bell Labs, demonstrating two-photon absorption. It turns out that back in 1931, Maria Geppert Mayer, who was the second female Nobel laureate, calculated, one of the first calculations done with Dirac's radiation theory, calculated the probability of such processes. But for the first time, it was observed. And this was, Bella also did this in gases. Bell Labs group did it in calcium fluoride dope with europium-2+. So I'd like to spend the last few moments just talking about my brief experiment that I did, which was my first experiment in nonlinear optics. I came to Bell Labs in the spring of 61, turned on my ruby lasers, was looking for what happened with a spectrograph when you hit a transparent material with a ruby laser. And the answer was not much, nothing that I could see. But then Franken's paper arrived, and I realized that I didn't know that a center of symmetry was not good for second harmonic generation experiments. So I quickly switched to potassium dihydrogen phosphate and found some very mysterious things going on. If you look at second harmonic generation in potassium dihydrogen phosphate, this is these pictures are angular directions of second harmonic light. Here's the direction in the direction of the incident laser beam, which is being generated under non-phase match conditions. As you change the angle of the crystal, this ring begins to become smaller diameter. When it hits the direction of the incident light, the intensity of the second harmonic goes up enormously by factors of hundreds and thousands, and then continuing to turn the crystal, you get a smaller radius. And indeed, what's happening here is that at the magic angle where the increase occurs, you're in fact matching the refractive indices of the second harmonic and the fundamental. What are the rings? No time to explain this diagram, but the rings represent the locus of directions in which the incident laser light, represented by this K1, can mix with scattered, very small amounts of scattered light, which are there in all directions, the vector K1 prime, to generate phase-matched second harmonic generation. So in the presence of uniform scattering and a very high intensity beam, that locus is a circle. And you see a ring whose variation you can calculate. After this work, there were a lot of other suggestions and developments in nonlinear optics. There were suggestions, for example, of possibility of parametric amplification, parametric oscillators. One of these suggestions came from Akhmanov and Kochlov, who were seen here, Akhmanov here, Kochlov here with Bloembergen at the University of Moscow, and they were to play a big role in future work in nonlinear optics. A really important step was Q-switching by Bob Hellworth. He had the idea that if you have two reflectors, you put in a Kerr cell, which effectively stops the reflections. You can pump this ruby laser up to a very, very high inversion. When you open the Kerr cell, you find that the power comes out about a factor of 100 times larger, at least, than the laser. And that revolutionized nonlinear optics. One of the first things it did was to show that a strange new line came out of the laser when you did that. First, it wasn't known what this new coherent light was, but in fact it was the stimulated emission from the nitrobenzene solution that made up the Curcel, and stimulated Raman light was discovered. And this was the way that a number of discoveries in nonlinear optics actually happened. So to wrap up this exciting period of 1960 to 1962, a lot got done. There were a lot of but the applications were really slow to come. One important medical application at that time was the use of ruby laser to destroy retinal tumors. And that experiment, that work on the first experiment with humans was done in December of 61 in New York. All the other lasers were yet to come. The exciting story of this semiconductor, which revolutionized all of this, of course, we're going to hear some of the results of that in the next talk. The CO2 laser of Kumar Patel came shortly thereafter, and about 95% of what you heard last evening at the public lecture also came afterwards. But this was an exciting time. Thank you very much.
Can you speak up?
May add something to this fascinating historical review. We usually tend to wait for many years in order to observe historical milestones. Perhaps there is something that happened less than a year ago in the history of laser development that should be mentioned. I don't know if everybody would know that, but less than a year ago, an X-ray laser was demonstrated in LCLS in SLAC for the first time, very bright X-ray radiation, spatially coherent, was demonstrated in LCLS at SLAC, lasing at 1.5 angstrom. And I think this, even though it's a short time, it is going to be an historical milestone. Just wanted to add that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you.
If I can add just one brief comment on the fact that Maiman's paper was rejected by Physical Review Letters. Goudsmit did announce an embargo on further Maser papers, and so Maiman didn't get through. But in that fall, Norman Ramsey and I published the paper on the hydrogen Maser, and that did get through. And possibly it's because Sam Goudsmit knew Norman Ramsey and did not know Maiman.